Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? I bet you heard that. That is the sound of the beverage that this episode is brought to you by. This episode is brought to you by the beverage beer. Nice, cold, Australian beer. Actually, this is not Australian beer. This is French beer. Saint-Étienne. The cheapest beer in all of Aldi. I think it's the cheapest beer you can get in Australia. But tell you what, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. I've had worse beers, believe it or not. It's better than most craft beers. I'm gonna throw that out there. Most craft beers I have, they're like, can you taste the honey and elderberry? And I'm like, yes, I can. And I'm not eating porridge. I'm drinking beer. So get that freaking honey and elderberry out of here. Yes, I can taste the hint of orange peel. Thanks. Do you have any without the orange peel? Because it's beer. You know what I mean? And yet it's the most expensive beer. Because it's crafty. Lovely beer. My body, by the way, is doing all kinds of strange things today. My knee is, I don't know what it's doing. It feels like something's about to rip in my knee and in my ankle of my right leg. If I move too quickly, I have a feeling I'm about to, like, seriously, like, tear a ligament in half or something. I don't know what's happening in there, but I've been trying to like stretch it all day, but it's only making it worse. So if I end up in hospital in the next day or two, it's because I've snapped my leg in half. I don't know what's going on there. I'm also struggling to swallow my saliva, which is a weird ailment to have. I don't really think I've ever had that before. So I figured, screw it, have a beer. That'll cure all these things. If I'm not online tomorrow, it's because I'm dead of knee, ankle, and esophagus-based injuries. We're talking about, while we're here, Anna Karenina, Part 5, Chapter 28. Gwennael said, I think the ramifications... Oh, wait. The discussion prompt was, Anna's mood is now hot and cold to Vronsky. What's happening between them? Gwennael, I think the ramifications of what she has done have finally hit Anna. She followed her heart, and as a result, she lost both her son and her social status. Now that the excitement of their forbidden relationship has worn off, Anna has to be examining her situation pretty hard and wondering if it was all worth it. I am guessing that she will start seeing all Vronsky's flaws in vivid detail soon. What was she complaining about with Karenin? She didn't like the cartilage on his ears. I expect the same criticisms about Vronsky soon. Very, very good point. Gwennael. She was complaining about the cartilage in his ears, and she did just seem to be repulsed by him, revolted by him even, in some bits of the book. to a degree where it's like she was just disgusted by his presence, by him trying to touch her hand, she withdrew her hand. And so she was very able to project disgust onto him that I don't think was all warranted. You know, fair, she's not attracted to him. She's fallen out of attraction to him. That's fine. But anyone would think that he was repulsive, the way she was acting. And I think she can just as easily, or she has just as effectively, projected attraction onto Vronsky. That's what I think's happened. I don't think Vronsky is nearly as attractive as she thought he was. And I think she's starting to see that now. Thermos of Beer said, high society. Oh, wait. Wait, I have to go up a level of comment. I am Norwegian. Said, now we're getting more into social commentary. I would have expected Petersburg to be a little more lax than Vronsky seems to think that they are. I don't really understand what it means to be locked out of society like Anna seemingly is now. I understand the rumor mill and the judging, but could she not move in society if she endured those things? It's strange, too, that nobody had any issues with the cheating when it was just a romantic fling, but now that it's a serious, people don't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole until Anna has formally switched husbands. Thermosov beers at high society loves gossip and rumors and scandals. There's nothing like watching someone fall. I think people looked the other way when she was cheating with Vronsky and keeping up appearances with Karenin. At least in that there was deniability. Leaving Karenin made it a scandal, and no one wants to be a part of this scandal. She completely destroyed her family. She ruined her husband both emotionally and career-wise, and abandoned her son. I am sure her life has become a very popular topic with the people she used to call friends, and none of those folk want their good name associated with hers. Astrologer Plus said, quite a good depiction of a downfall in a society and coming to terms with day-to-day living, I think. Being in a relationship is an everyday thing, not a few romantic gestures with nice scenery. The banality and plainness of spending a lot of time together is written quite well here. I think it's a given that she would be shunned from society, having done what she did to her family. I don't blame her for leaving Karenin, though, as it seems like he did not understand her and was 20 years her senior. She was too hasty with her actions, though, but that's what makes the book interesting, I suppose. Who in this book is attractive, do you think? Who has an attractive personality? And I don't mean necessarily sexually attractive or even romantically attractive, just generally attractive. Someone who draws you in, makes you feel good, seems like a decent person. Who is an attractive person in this book? Maybe Levin? Maybe Kitty? I don't know. It's a book where I'm not really on anyone's side. And that's a bother to me. Anyway. Who cares about what is a bother to me? Anyway, when we've got chapter 29 to read. Let's read it. Let's read it. Chapter 29. One of Anna's reasons for returning to Russia was to see her son. From the day she left Italy, the thought of that meeting did not cease to agitate her. The nearer they came to Petersburg, the greater its joy and importance appeared. She did not ask herself how she should contrive it. It seemed to her natural and simple that she should see her son when she was in the same town with him, but on reaching Petersburg, her present social position presented itself clearly to her, and she realized that it would be difficult to arrange the meeting. She had been in Petersburg 2 days. The thought of her son did not leave her for an instant, but she had not yet seen him. She felt she had not the right to go straight to the house where she might encounter Karenin. Possibly they might not even admit her. It was painful to her even to think of riding to and coming into contact with her husband. She could be calm only when she did not think of him. To meet her son when he was out for a walk, after finding out when and where he went, was not enough. She had been preparing herself so for that meeting, and so much to say to him, and so much wanted to embrace and kiss him. Serza's old nurse might have helped and advised her, but she was no longer in Karenin's household. In this uncertainty and in searching for the old nurse, 2 days had gone by. Having heard about Karenin's intimate friendship with the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, Anna on the third day resolved to write her a letter, which cost her much effort, and in which she intentionally mentioned that permission to see her son must depend on her husband's magnanimity. She knew that if that letter were shown to him, he, continuing his magnanimous role, would not refuse her request. The commissionaire who delivered her letter brought back the most cruel and unexpected reply that there would be no answer. Never had she felt so humiliated as when, having called in the commissionaire, she heard from him the full account of how he had waited and had then been told that there would be no answer. Anna felt herself humiliated and wounded, but she saw that the Countess Lydia Ivanovna was right from her own point of view. Her grief was the more poignant because she had to bear it alone. She could not share it with Vronsky and did not wish to. She knew that, though he was the chief cause of her misery, the question of her seeing her son would seem to him quite unimportant. She knew he would never be able to appreciate the depth of her anguish, and that his coldness, if the matter were mentioned, would make her hate him. And she feared that more than anything else in the world, and therefore hid from him everything concerning her son. Having spent all that day at the hotel considering how she might see her son, she resolved to write to her husband. She had already composed the letter when she received Lydia Ivanovna's reply. The Countess's silence had made her feel humble, but the letter, and what she read between its lines, so irritated her, its malevolence seemed so revolting when compared with her passionate and legitimate love for her son, that she became indignant with others and ceased to blame herself. That coldness, that pretense of feeling, she said to herself, they want to wound and torture the child, and shall I submit to them? Not on any account. She is worse than I. Anyhow, I don't lie. And there and then she resolved that next day, Serge's birthday, she would go straight to her husband's house and would bribe the servants or deceive them, but would at any cost see her son and destroy that monstrous falsehood with which they surrounded the unfortunate child. She drove to the toy shop, purchased a lot of toys, and devised a plan of action. She would go early in the morning, at about 8, when Karenin would certainly not be up. She would have ready in her hand some money to give to the hall porter and the footman, in order that they should let her in. Without raising her veil, she would say she had been sent by Serza's godfather to wish him many happy returns of the day, and that she was to put the toys by his bedside. The only thing she did not prepare was what she would say to her son. Much as she thought about that, she could not prepare the words. Next morning, Anna went alone, and at 8 o'clock, got out of the hired carriage and rang the bell at the front door of the house, which used to be her home. "Go and see what it is." "It's some lady," said Kapitanich, who was not yet dressed, and in overcoat and galoshes peeped from the window at the veiled lady standing close to the door. His assistant, a lad whom Anna did not know, had hardly opened the door when she entered, and taking a 3-ruble note from her muff, hastily thrust it into his hand. "Serza, Sergei Alexeyevich," she said, and walked on. After examining the note, the porter's assistant stopped her at the inner glass door. "Whom do you want?" he asked. She did not hear his words and made no reply. Noticing the stranger's confusion, Kapitanich himself came out, admitted her, and inquired what she wanted. "I come from Prince Skorodumov to see Sergei Alexeyevich," said she. "He is not up yet," said the hall porter, carefully scrutinizing her face. Anna had not foreseen at all that the totally unaltered appearance of the hall of the house where she had lived for 9 years would so deeply affect her. One memory after another, both joyful and painful, rose in her mind, and for a moment she forgot why she had come. "Would you like to wait?" said Kapitanich, helping her off with her cloak. Having done so, she glanced again at her face, and recognizing her, silently bowed low. "Come in, Your Excellency," he said. She wished to speak, but her voice refused to utter a sound. With a look of guilty entreaty at the old man, she went with light steps up the stairs, bending forward and catching the steps with his galoshes. Kapitanich ran after her, trying to overtake her. "The tutor may be there and not yet dressed. I will announce you." Anna continued to ascend the familiar steps without understanding what the old man was saying. "This way, please. To the left. Please excuse its not being quite clean. He has been moved to an old sitting room now," said the hall porter, panting. "Allow me, please, wait a little, Your Excellency. I'll just look in," he said, having overtaken her. He opened a big door and vanished behind it. Anna paused and waited. "He's only just woken up," said the porter when he came out. Just as he spoke, Anna heard the sounds of a child yawning. She recognized her son by the sound of the yawn and pictured him vividly before her. "Let me in, let me in," she cried, and entered at the big door. To the right of the door stood a bed on which sat the boy, his nightshirt unbuttoned, bending his little body backward, stretching himself and finishing his yawn. At the moment, when his lips were closing, they extended into a blissful smile, sleepy smile. And with that smile he again fell slowly and sweetly backwards. "Sirza," she whispered, drawing nearer with inaudible steps. During the time they had been parted and under the influence of that gush of love which she had felt for him of late, she had always imagined him as a little fellow of 4, the age when she had loved him best. Now he was not even as she had left him. He was still further removed from the 4-year-old child. He had grown still more and had got thinner. What did it mean? How thin his face was, how short his hair, how long his arms, how changed since she had left him. But still it was he. The slope of the head was his, the lips were his, the soft neck and the broad shoulders. "Sirza," she repeated, just above the child's ear. He raised himself again on his elbow, moved his tousled head from side to side as if seeking for something, and opened his eyes. Silently and questioningly he gazed for a few moments at his mother, who stood motionless before him. Then suddenly smiling blissfully, he closed his heavy eyelids and fell once more, not backwards, but forwards into her arms. "Sirza, my dear little boy," she uttered, catching her breath and embracing his plump little body. "Mama," he muttered, wriggling about in her arms as so as to touch them with different body parts of his body. Sleepily smiling, with closed eyes, he moved his plump hands from the back of his bed to her shoulders, leaning against her and enveloping her in that sweet scent of sleepiness and warmth which only children possess, and began rubbing himself against her neck and shoulder. "I knew," he said, opening his eyes, "today is my birthday. I knew you would come. I'll get up directly." While saying this, he was again falling asleep. Anna watched him with greedy eyes. She noticed how he had grown and changed during her absence. She recognized, and yet did not quite recognize, his bare legs, now so big, which he had freed from the blanket, and his cheeks now grown thinner, and the short locks of hair at the back of his head, where she had so often kissed him. She touched it all and could not speak. Tears were choking her. "What are you crying about, Mama?" he asked, now quite awake. "Mama, what are you crying about?" he exclaimed in a fretful voice. "I won't cry. I'm crying for joy. It's so long since I saw you. I won't, she said, swallowing her tears and turning away. "But it's time for you to get dressed," she said, after a pause when she had recovered, and without releasing his hand, she sat down by his bed on a chair on which his clothes were lying ready. "How do you dress without me? How do you?" She tried to speak simply and cheerfully, but could not, and turned away again. "I don't wash with cold water. Papa says I mustn't. You have not seen Vasily Lukitch. He will come presently, and you are sitting on my clothes." And Sirza burst out laughing. She looked at him and smiled. "Mama, dearest darling," he shouted, again throwing himself upon her and embracing her, as if he only now, having seen her smile, clearly realized what had happened. "You don't want that," he said, taking off her bonnet, and on seeing her without it, he began kissing her again, as though he had only just seen her. "Well, and what did you think about me? You did not think I was dead." "I never believed it." "You didn't believe it, my darling." I knew, he cried, repeating his favorite phrase, and seizing her hand, which was caressing his hair, he pressed her palm to his mouth, covering it with kisses. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down, a little reunion, sneaky reunion, quite lovely. Quite touching. Have your say about this one over at the subreddit. Thanks very, very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.